So this is an interview I did with Christian Kastner, who's a VFX supervisor for Framestore. He's one of the teams that worked on Captain Marvel, did the special effects for a lot of the environmental work, some of the earlier stuff on the Topher planet at the beginning, and some of the digi-double stuff for Brie Larson. And in this interview, we just talk about what it's like being a VFX supervisor, what it's like working through the sort of Marvel production process. And it's a really long, detailed interview that goes into quite a lot of depth on certain subjects, and I think that if you've got an interest in behind the scenes of filmmaking, then it'll be really interesting. Just one thing to point out before we go into it, because of the way that the recording was set up, sometimes we miss out like the first word of Christian's responses, so that might be a little confusing at times, but hopefully you'll be able to figure out what he actually said from how the sentences follow and how they end. So yeah, just bear in mind that sometimes bits and pieces of his answers are missing. Thank you, and I hope you enjoy. Thank you very much for taking the time to do this.
No problem at all.
So the first question I was hoping to ask you about is just to go over your own career personally. You've had a really impressive journey moving through lots of different roles, and I was wondering if you could talk a little about that and how you ended up as a VFX supervisor.
Sure, no problem. I studied communications design and art direction, so graphic design. I worked about 4 years in an advertising agency in print and did lots of print stuff. At the time, ILM still had their commercials division, and they did lots of commercials, and obviously NBC and Framestore all had their commercials divisions, and it was always something that interested me. I have the benefit of an older brother who lived abroad, and at the time I wasn't too keen. I stayed, you know, I was one of the ones who wanted to stay home and, you know, in the hometown. And then by the time I was 28, I sort of looked at my brother's life and my life and thought, I'm probably missing something. So I moved to San Francisco, got my Master's of Fine Arts at the Academy of Art University. And to be honest, at that point, I was still sort of focused on commercials and doing advertising.
Yeah.
But I sort of stumbled to some friends and some connections that I had. I sort of stumbled into film. And once you're in, you develop a strange just stay in there because it's cool. And, you know, it wasn't really, it's really weird. A lot of people are, they want to work on movies and they want to make these films and everything. It wasn't really on my roadmap, and I sort of stumbled in and then sort of discovered it by accident, really. So I started working at the orphanage, then moved to London, started at a Framestore. Framestore was actually one of the companies that really appealed to me from the outside for the work that they were doing. Again, initially, you know, driven by the commercials work they were doing. But even though I had worked as an art director, I had to sort of step back and, you know, start rotopaint and compositing bottom chain in the film industry. So I still had that commercial as an option in the back of my head. So in the film industry, people know people, and, you know, your name, like you socialize and your name might get passed along. And once you're in a company, then it's sort of what you make out of it.
Yeah.
And
hello.
Hello, Harrison.
Hello, sorry.
I was in my own bubble and I was talking and just realised you were not there anymore.
the last thing that I got was you talked up to joining Framestore and enjoying working with the people there.
Yes. So obviously I had, I joined Framestore, and I think having that background in art direction, and I didn't start my career when I was like 19 years old. I was already over 30 and I had some experience.
Yeah.
So for me learning the film side of things was only partially new, because it was the way of doing things, and there were new tools and new, like one of my teachers always said, like any new software is just a new brush for an artist, really. So I just had to learn a few new brushes, really, to sort of translate what I used to do. So despite starting at Framestore as a junior compositor, I did have some experience in team leading and, you know, organizing and, you know, running big projects and such. So I became a sequence lead, and I stumbled into supervision really by chance as well, because the supervisor that I worked with on the first project, the second project, I think Prince Caspian, John Tom, he was going to supervise Avatar, and he said sort of, I think you're ready. I don't think we have anyone else. Do you want to be my comp soup? And I just naively said yes, not really knowing what I got myself into. But, you know, it's sort of one thing that about InStore is always that I enjoyed working with the team. So, I have to work hard, but at the same time, you have to, enjoy working who you're working with. And I think people say you're lucky, or it's not really luck. I think it's a lot of hard work and determination of what you want to achieve. And obviously for me, because I was changing my career, starting with an entry level salary at the time wasn't great, and my parents seriously questioned my decision. But it was visible quite quickly that I could progress quite quickly because of the experience that I had, and then obviously gain trust from some supervisors who then give you opportunities, and then you prove yourself again, and then sort of like it becomes an inevitable cycle. And it was when Framestore wanted to open the Montreal office again, I was only a comp sup at the time with some experience, and they needed a head of the 2D department here because they needed to make decisions about recruiting, and I sort of put my hand up to do that without any real promises, but I said I'm happy to take on the head of 2D role, but I do want to stick to my supervision. So I did those two in parallel for some time.
Right.
And then obviously as we were growing and as things were progressing here in Montreal, there was an option for me to take on. I was working closely with Jonathan Faulkner on The Edge of Tomorrow, and he was coming out on a regular basis from London. He sort of said, I think you can handle your stuff on your own. It wasn't official promotion, but he gave me the responsibility. And in hindsight, like after that, I got promoted to become a visual effects supervisor here and took on my own shows. And yeah, that's how I ended up here.
So what would you say is the most important quality for someone in a VFX supervisor role to have? Like what's the most important thing for you to be able to do in terms of skills?
I almost say you have to be a diplomat. It sounds weird, but like I think as a visual effects supervisor, and it's similar to sort of any sort of supervisory roles you have to do, where you have obviously you have to be the mediator and sort of translate what the client wants into what is possible and within the budget. And I think that's an artistic skill that you have to have. And when I studied graphic design, we weren't allowed to touch a computer, not because it was early days, but we weren't allowed to touch a computer until the fourth semester or something, because the philosophy of the director was that computer is not right. Like you have to train your eye. We did writing with brushes and writing with calligraphy, and everything was, it's about the fundamentals of artistic skills. And I think photography and all those fundamentals really helped me in my career now, because the attention to detail that really is what's really required. It's the tenacity and the attention to detail that really, combined with a good diplomatic communication skills with your clients, that's where you will excel. Like it's not that I'm particularly good at one thing in the CG thing. Like I think it's sort of the broad understanding of everything, and the artistic skill has to be there. Mm. But at the same time, you have to be a good team leader. You have to sort of identify the problems, and I think maybe that's sort of a good summary. You have to be able to empty the possible problems in order to give your client a good visual result, because that's essentially only what they're after. And when they say they want a moon and a stick for £5, then you have to sort of find a way to do it, to give them a good moon and a stick for £5. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Saying no is not the option. That's not what they come to you. They come to you to, like, they say, I have £5, but I want a moon and a stick. What can you give me? What can you make out of it? And I think it's what you make out of it. That skill, I think, is really, I think, what good visual effects supervisor, that's really, I think, is a good summary, I think.
Yeah, so you're saying that you need to be very resourceful and to sort of work with what you've got to deliver exactly what the client's asking for.
Yeah, I think so. And, You want your client to basically go, wow, you made this for £5, rather than saying, oh, you made that. yeah, you only gave me £5. Like, so I think that's not the approach. It's a problem solver. It's a solution finder. And you know, what's our best possible outcome? And, you know, sometimes you just have to say also, okay, in order to have a happy client, maybe for this particular challenge, we will have to invest a little on our side, but we can maybe, you know, take a few days out of the bid from other angles. And, you know, so you have to be sort of being on your toes, I think, a little bit.
So now moving on to Captain Marvel itself.
Yeah.
As with any project of this scale, there are obviously quite a lot of different VFX companies all contributing to the project. And I think in the case of Captain Marvel, I think there seems to be about 12. And I was wondering what that's like from your perspective, you know, working on part of the visual effects while there are other teams doing different bits here and there.
I think sort of historically, it always depends on your client. Obviously, when we started out, you know, when I started out 12 years ago, that was the norm because no one company had the, you know, the render power or capacity or was big enough to take on, you know, massive shows
right.
at the time. So it was sort of normal that work was usually split. And then we sort of moved into that area where actually we were taking on entire projects because we had big enough render farm, enough storage, and you know, like, so we, like, the facilities, you know, it's not just Framestore, but the facilities around the world had grown. I think, you know, maybe, you know, Weta New Zealand was one of the, I'm not sure if they've been the first ones, but sort of that model of James Cameron working with just one facility or doing Lord of the Rings as one facility, that was sort of new because it was they were the only ones who could handle all that work. So it's not really new to us how we work, that, you know, work is split. And usually the clients are pretty good in dividing the work in a sensible way. And that's not really something that you have influence in. It's at the bidding stage where, you know, the stuff gets divided, and, you know, sometimes there will be overlap or changes throughout the edit process, but it's sort of a normal process. And I think for any one company to do 2,500 or 3,000 visual effects shots in that sort of schedule, your visual effects company would have to be such an overhead that it wouldn't be feasible for anyone to take it on, because you would have to grow to, like, and let's say 100 or 1,500 people for that short amount of time. But then you, like, how do you backfill that? Like, because Marvel's not a constant stream. It's just the risk on their side. You know, if something, you know, goes wrong, they still have, you know, they still have a movie. I think they're quite good at it. And it doesn't make it necessarily easier, but it doesn't really make it complicated, because I think by history we are set up to be collaborating, and, you know, as I said the work usually is split in a sensible way.
You just mentioned collaborating, so do you ever, like, get to see what the other effects teams are working on? Is that something that's normal, or is it very much that you all, like, work on your own individual shots?
I think on the shot side, there will always be scenarios where, like, we shared some shots with Digital Domain because they were doing the shapeshifter effect. So we had some shots in our sequence that where we basically provided them with a background because we were doing the environment work,
right.
And we then gave that work back to Digital Domain, who were doing the transformations. But that's usually sort of kept to a minimum. Usually 90% of the work will be short work that only you do. However, there's the way Marvel works, they usually have key vendors developing key effects. So, for example, Trickster was developing very early on, developing the photon blast for Beerus. ILM was developing the Digi Double of Brie Larson. We were developing the DT doubles of all the rest of the Star Force members, because they're sort of like, okay, Framestore has, you know, let's say 50 shots with these DT doubles, and RM has, you know, E shots with where they need a DT double of fear. So it makes sense that's sort of like the look development is split amongst the vendors, I think based on skill and award. I guess the award goes with the skill. So, like, what the vendors think you're really good at, they will give you that portion of the work.
Right.
And then you also get, usually look develop the biggest part. parts of your sequence or of your assets, and then they will show you what the other vendors are doing, and this is what you have to match, and this is, you know, sometimes Marvel will try to get you to share as much as you can, but sometimes, you know, sometimes just visual references is what you get, and sometimes you get, you know, more elaborate setup. Obviously, when it comes to like GT doubles and stuff, like, there's no point in just going by the visual, but then those models and those textures are usually shared and then just being translated into your pipeline.
And so you mentioned doing the digi doubles for the other members of the team. And
yeah.
Apart from that, what other effects did Framestore specifically deliver? And like, roughly how many shots was it?
It was, I think, between 130 and 140 shots. So it wasn't a particularly big show for us. But, you know, it was a very ambitious schedule. Even though Framestore has worked with Marvel before, it was the first time that they gave that chunk of the work to the Montreal office only. And you can tell them as many times as you want. We're one company. We're working the same ways. It's like, yeah, let me see. You know, like. But you know, obviously they wanted to take they wanted to give us the opportunity, and we got some really, really cool stuff. So in the movie, sort of when we establish the beginning history of Veers, is so our work is the Topher environment. So when the alien planet,
yeah,
so the planet engulfed into the big sort of storm with its, you know, ring around it, and everything is sort of in a twilight, and the spaceship attacking the planet with the rocket launchers,
yeah,
and then the Kree alien ship diving into the water, torpedoing out the Star Force, where we actually see me with her costume and with her mohawk for the first time.
Oh, right.
Coming out of the water, until she gets captured. That was sort of our main bulk of the work. We did another establisher of one of the buildings where she goes in to charge up. And yeah, then we did a small section, you know, where she goes through all the colors of her suits to find the
oh,
Captain
right.
Marvel suits.
Yeah.
We did that section as well. Like, that's just,
oh, cool,
you know, eight shots or so. But the bulk of the work, and the, you know, the most challenging work, was really the establishing that alien world and, you know, that look and feel, and that was really cool.
And in terms of that alien world, what kind of, brief? How much direction did they give you, and what specifically did they tell you they were looking for?
That, you know, a lot of concept art and basic artwork is done before,
yeah,
before filming actually starts, because they, you know, they have to decide when they want to shoot it, what's the scale of the environment, and they want to decide whether they want to shoot in studio or shoot on location. So there was artwork done of, you know, of what the world should be like, and, you know, like, is it, they decided, like, oh, if we have two suns, then we can always sort of tell it's an alien world, because it doesn't exist, because it needs to be a habitable planet, yet needs to be sort of otherworldly. And they settled on shooting this on location because they thought they found a quarry in California where they thought it was a suitable location. So, like, they take some pictures of that location, and then they make an artwork around this, like, oh yeah, this is what we can do. And then they modified it a little bit with, you know, well, they just had blue-colored sand that they added to the quarry. And,
right,
you know, they sort of get away from the Earth-like environment. And then they shot everything, well, we shot everything at night to have full control over the lighting. Even though it was meant to be sort of twilight alien day, we wanted full control. We didn't want any sort of harsh sunlight that would sort of give away the, you know, the Earth-like environment. So it was a dual-tone yellow and blue sort of look that they wanted. But I'm really glad they could have easily gone into the studio, but I'm really glad they went into a location.
Does that make it easier from your perspective?
I think it makes it it makes it easier to get a good looking image. Mm. It makes it harder to get there a little bit, because obviously in a studio, you have full control over every light, and you can shoot as long as you want. You don't have to wait until actually completely sundown, until, you know.
Yeah.
By the time the birds come up, you're like, oh, we need to wrap up soon, you know, because sun's coming up. coming up, life's changing. But actually, your shooting window is slightly smaller. But what we actually learned a few times now on a few projects is that if you shoot it on location for real outside, I think the visuals are so much better than shooting in the studio, because we had a few shots that were a reshoot. They were shot in the studio, and the audience won't be able to tell, and probably the average customer will not be able to tell. But we can tell that it's not quite as successful as the, you know, whatever was shot on location. So shooting on location has the downside that you don't really get a nice blue screen where you can key easily. There's a lot more prep work that he's doing, but I think the visuals in the end are much better and much more successful.
If there's any consolation, I didn't notice a difference between where these reshoots would have been. It all looked consistently
good. That's the idea,
And I suppose that's one thing I did want to ask you about is the what you think the role of special effects is in storytelling. Because I suppose, like you said, the idea is that most people don't think about it, and that the idea is for the audience to just be swept away by the effects.
Exactly. I think there's a book called The Invisible Art, which is about matte painting. But I think with any visual effects, so, and even if it's a talking creature, the secret there is you support the story, because you're not an art exhibition. You don't get your audience to come to the cinema and look at this one beautiful visual effects shot. Your audience comes to the cinema to be entertained while eating popcorn and drinking a soft drink or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's your objective. And it's enhancing the storytelling, and actually I think if your audience comes out of the movie and asks me, so what did you guys do? Like, that's always the best question, because it's always, because it doesn't matter, we did our job, because we got you to focus on the story and what the director had to say, or the storyline of the plot. So I think that's really the secret to good visual effects, is that you become noticeable and just really support the story.
Yeah, definitely. And how would you compare doing something like, say, you mentioned a spaceship effect, to doing a character? Like, what are the sort of differences in approach that you would have to do between doing something that's maybe inanimate versus a moving character like the CG doubles?
Luckily, these days, I think Framestore historically was sort of this sort of niche go-to house for talking creatures or creatures in general. Because we're really good at the animation and, getting the look of the creatures. And over the time, I think, sort of Gravity was our first big one where we...
Without creatures.
There was a big show where we only had environment work to do and hard surface work to do. And luckily now, with physically accurate rendering and that sort of, that has all become a bit more straightforward. But it's all about, they're a very different thing, doing a spaceship versus doing a character. And I think the trickier bit for digi-doubles is that you have a plate to match to. There will be shots of that actor, and then again, you want to be in a spot where your audience doesn't notice that all of a sudden it's in the case of Spider-Man, obviously, human being is impossible for him to do certain things. You believe it as a character, so the audience believes it as a character. So obviously, visual effects just needs to make sure that you're not all of a sudden completely different in the look and feel of the character than is established by the actor. And I think that's a real, real big challenge to have a digi-double that sort of doesn't get the audience. Long time ago, digi-doubles were only really, really small, and it's only now that we're sort of getting a bit braver and doing sort of some medium close-up shots with digi-doubles where, it's easier to do it in CG . And then spaceships, all about the detail, and they are very different things. In these days, if you do a vehicle, I'm not going to say spaceship, but if you do a vehicle in CG or something hard surface, usually do it because it is cheaper than to do it practically. So usually you have to destroy it and, multiple times So the build is not just the cell. So if you have to destroy something, obviously you have to build everything that's inside it as well, because you're going to rip the whole thing open, So they are very different beasts, and really challenging they can be, I think.
What would you say was the single biggest challenge with this particular film? Is there something that you're especially proud of because of how tricky it was to pin down?
It was probably the environment, because there was an aspect of art direction that we needed to get right and translate this shoot into a believable environment. Same time, everything, I think what was the most challenge for us was everything was supposed to be covered in sort of alien fog. So it wasn't just supposed to be your hanging morning fog that was, you know, the static or anything. So there was always a life to it, and it was finding that what is it that it doesn't look like dry ice, or it doesn't look like just smoke. So creatively, that was quite a big challenge. And then computationally, you know, the sand quarry, the set was quite big already, but when they cut the initial director's cut together, they quickly realized that the set have the scope of the environment that they wanted. So we ended up splitting up the set into the four pieces and making it four times larger. We took the entrance of the set, the middle section of the set, cut that in two, and then the temple section of the set. So we split it four times further apart, and then all of that had to be filled with fog. And that all needed to be sort of render in a realistic way that it was quite a big area. It was several hundred square meters. And then obviously you have wide shots and medium close-up shots and close-up shots and, you know, medium wide. So they all require a different level of, it's not that you, with practical effects, you just, you know, you can go in as close and or as wide as you want, because the physics are always the same. For simulation purposes, it's completely inefficient to do one simulation for the whole thing and then, you know, put your camera over there, because you would have to create so much data for your close-up shots. It would be insane to render that in a wide shot. So I think for me, the end result, the art direction of that and giving that sort of an otherworldly feel, I think that was, I think, the biggest challenge. Technically, the biggest challenge was the shot of the Star Force underwater, I would say, when they come out of the spaceship, torpedoed towards camera.
Yeah.
Because we did that under, that's a full CG underwater shot. So everything in the shot is CG. There was no play for Bree or anyone. And we needed to slow down time. It's not 100% a bullet time, but it's almost a bullet time. You slow down time, the camera travels around Bree, and then they shoot off again. So it's already, I think it's a 500 frame shot.
Right.
And the difficulty there is to, how do you do your effects to simulate bubbles and, you know, hair movement and, you know, all the particulate underwater in a physically accurate way? Fine to do that for that, you know, slow motion, because you can do that easily. It's fine to do it in real time either, but to do it real time, slow motion and real time is quite hard, because you have to change your simulation behavior over time.
That was really
challenging. And normally what we would do, you know, on shorter shots where this was the case, where something slows down and, you know, the short shot, you would just do the whole thing in slow motion and then just speed up, retime it and speed it up. But for this shot, it was already 500 frames long. So if you slow that down 100 times, that all of a sudden makes a 250,000 frame shot.
Right, I see.
And, you know, and you would throw away 90% of that work, because 90% of the work would be real time, would be sped up 500%. It wasn't an option for us. So technically, for us to find a way, how can we do that, you know, what seems trivial, well, it's just a retime. I just go real time, five slower, and real time. It was a huge technical challenge to get the simulation on all fronts going, and, you know, make it work. Because because it was bubbles that were emitted from that character, we couldn't easily just go and say, oh, we'll chop the shot in three and do three different simulations, because you're slowing down, so your bubble simulation that has just happened in real time all of a sudden has to go. You have to be, you're basically eyewitness to the slowdown effect. And so the bubble that came out in real time 2 frames ago all of a sudden has to all behave 500 times slower. So that was a huge shot.
And that's something that no audience member is ever going to conceivably think of. Like, they're never going to consider that. And I guess it comes back to what you were talking about with the best special effects being ones where the audiences don't notice. Because I would never have even thought about the challenges with speeding it up and slowing it down. especially when, as you said, it was a completely CGI shot. But it, if anything, it's made it more difficult.
Exactly, because, you know, if you shot it for real, like, let's just assume you were able to shoot this for real, you could just shoot the whole thing at 500 or, you know, 500 frames a second or 1,000 frames a second, and then you just retime whatever you don't need and make that real time, make it 500 times faster. But we were to generate X bubbles and, you know, particular simulation for the hair, or basically 99% of that data you would never need. And FX data is quite heavy, so we would have probably not even had the storage to do it.
Right. And so we have... I got sent over a quote that came from the visual effects supervisor for the film. And it said that they wanted the effects to look cool, photographic, and then physically accurate, and in that order. And I was wondering if that's something that you could maybe talk about a little. Like, how did that factor into your work? Like, the priority of cool at number one, and then photographic and physically accurate afterwards.
Yeah, so I think that's actually something Chris Townsend said to us when we were working on some of the battle sequence just before Brie gets captured.
Yeah.
And the edit was changing. There was more shots, less shots, and then there was a battle, there was no battle, you know, like sort of that evolved a little bit. And then last minute they said, we really want to establish some of the powers that the individual characters have in your battle sequence for the movie, because this is setting up the scene. And, you know, there was one character, Bronsa, who didn't have an effect yet because, like, he was sort of a really strong guy.
Mm.
So we developed the gauntlets for him and this sort of superpower when he hits someone. And as sort of Chris said, like, the way it has to work for Marvel, first of all, it has to look cool, and then it has to look photographic, and then it has to be physically accurate, because in that order, it's because it needs to be, the audience needs to be, like wanting to jump up from the seat and go like, yeah, you know, like that's cool.
Yeah.
But then for him, obviously, again, what's important these days is that it's photographically seamless with the rest of the footage. So you're basically, you need to, even if it's a full CT shot, you need to look at all the camera characteristics and lens operations and color behavior that what you see as an audience, you believe as a photographic image. And then if you can base it in some sort of physically accuracy or physical reality, because obviously we don't know how much or how one would react with a, you know, if someone has superpowers, what that means for the other person. But
yeah,
you still want to sort of, okay, if he gets hit and needs to land there, you still want to figure out the what's the parabolic trajectory between the two points to make it, you know, not a straight line and make it look really weird.
Right.
Even though it may not be physically possible to do this, it still has to adhere to the physics somehow.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. It's about making it look like it could physically happen, even if it is not strictly accurate. It just needs to look right to the audience.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, it needs to look right. And I think there was sort of a few, well, maybe a few more than 5 years ago, but a few more than 5 years ago, you could always have these sort of thoughts in a visual effects movie where you're like, yeah, that just looks just, I just don't buy it, you know, that could sort of, and I think visual effects in general have gotten so good at this now that, you know, we're starting to buy more and more, even if it's, you know, the Hulk destroying a building, because the relative physics are still sort of in their own world, correct?
Yeah.
I think what Chris was saying, it basically, like, it sums up what I said earlier, like, your audience just needs to believe it, and those three factors, because they need to like it and believe it, and I think those three factors, they need to go wanting to jump up from their seat because it's really cool what they do, and then not worry about that looks right, because it's physically, it looks believable. I think that's sort of the summary of it.
Yeah, yeah. So just to move back to something you mentioned earlier, which was the sequence where her suit's changing and going through the different colours. Was that... How does something like that work? Because obviously you've got a real person there with a costume that they'll be wearing on set, but you're making that change whilst it's moving around, you know, because she's playing with the thing on her arm. So you've got to, like, take into account the movements and the real person. How challenging is that kind of effect?
So luckily these days, with the quality of the rendering and the, you know, physics, like the... replication of renders that, you know, like if you give me a good reference of a real material, like a costume or a suit, we can recreate that these days. So traditionally, maybe a few years ago, we would have done that with lots of roto and sort of color grading and try to do it that way.
Yeah.
These days, we needed her in a suit anyway. We needed a really good looking digidouble of her anyway.
Yeah.
Well, we'll just do it in CG. So what we did is we curved the hand, the gloves, her hair, and her face.
Right.
Removed the entire body.
Oh, okay.
The entire suit.
Okay.
And replaced it with a CG suit. Obviously, you even don't want your directors to notice that. So what you want to do is just match move or like object track her performance accurately, because obviously the suit needed to stick to her head and to her arms and face. Yeah, what we did is we body tracked, match moved her exactly, and put our CG suits. And then our look dev, we could just say, hey, instead of green, it's blue. Or instead of, you know, black, it's now white. So that way, we then developed a sort of like a growth, sort of revealing with hexagons and on the suit that sort of was several layers of graphical elements that would be a long sort of complicated wipe from one color to the other.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Again, I completely did not realize that, you know, you got rid of that entire, it's so seamless with the real her.
Yeah, and I think it's sort of, I think we're confident enough these days that if we, like, there are shots in that sequence where she's actually wearing her real suit, and we're transitioning from her real suit to, like, sort of a CG suit and then back, that, like, the quality of the work that we can do these days, like, you will not be able to tell. And, like, we sometimes do that. We test our own clients by, we did that with Chris. We sent back one shot. We replaced her black and green suit with her black and green suit in CG. And
you couldn't tell the difference.
And I, like, his reaction was like, what are we looking at? And I was like, well, that's all I need to know, because this is a replaced suit and you don't spot it, you know? So that's, like, I think Nick did that on Blade Runner as well. Like, you do that sometimes too, when you have replaced something with exactly the same in CG and send it back, and then if the reaction is like, why are you sending me this? then you know it works, you know what I mean?
That's like a test. Yeah,
you can't do that too often, but every now and then you have to sneak it in.
Yeah. So looking into the future, what kind of projects have you got in the pipeline now?
I have currently joined the Aeronauts. It's an Amazon show.
Okay.
But we are over 550 people now in Montreal, so we're doing quite a few shows across London and Montreal offices and LA as well. So, you know, we're working on Mulan, you know, Avengers is still, I think it's almost done. I think it's out soon. So,
cool.
It's in the works, and then Spider-Man, Far From Home, Artemis Fowl. So we have a bunch of projects in the making. And I've just joined the team for Aeronauts to deliver that in the summer, and then after that I've not looked at it. What's after that?
What kind of work are you doing on Avengers? What sort of stuff have you been delivering for that one?
We're doing. I'm not sure how much can I give away for that. No, I'd rather not say it, to be honest.
Sorry, I understand.
It's all confidential, and, like, I don't want to be the one that had said something.
Yeah, no, I get it. You sort of covered this a little in the first question, but do you have any advice for someone who is looking to break into the visual effects industry?
I think understanding that artistic fundamentals are key. Like, when we started the office here, and obviously we had to build a new team, and, you know, we had some people from local but also from all over the world, and Montreal wasn't necessarily established as a visual effects location yet. But, you know, we had to sort of train some people up, and we had to sort of take a little bit of risk in hiring the odd people. What we usually go for is, who's a good artist,
yeah,
additional artist, can can always be a good artist, and you know, as I said, you know, another software is always, it's just another brush.
Yeah.
Obviously, if you have a skill for sculpture, you're, you know, more likely to become a modeler than a compositor. But if you're a photographer, you maybe you're more likely to become a compositor. Mm. So, you know, do not ever underestimate the need for having the fundamentals. Even art history, I must say, is important, because like storytelling is usually based on some sort of history, and visual storytelling usually refers to something that has been done. Maybe, you know, you will get, sometimes you will get artwork that's like, oh, this is, you know, whatever Kandinsky did, or this is what Leonardo da Vinci did, and you know, this is what we like about it. And the art fundamentals are never to be underestimated. And then if there's a younger generation, the computer doesn't really help you with anything. You just does what you want it to do. And I think understanding that, if you have a clear idea of constantly questioning the computer, what it shows you, I think that's sort of key. And then if you want to break into the visual effects industry, I think attend, like, because it's quite hard to get into, because there's a lot of good people and we get a lot of, you know, good applications.
Right.
But one thing that I think that's also key is to out there and look for visual effects events. Like, there's, you know, tons of conventions all over the place all the time, and you don't always have to strive to start working for ILM or DNEG or Framestore or MPC as your first employer. There's so many good all visual effects houses that you could get your foot into, and you know, conventions or exhibitions is always a good way. Internships, you know, it's once you're in, it's a lot of hard work, and I must admit, it's not a 9-to-5 office job. Like, it's
sure.
We're all here because we're passionate about what we do, and that's sort of, the producer sometimes like, what are you still doing here? Like, you need to go home. And I'm like, no, but I still just need to finish this. I just, you know, sometimes you're in a groove or something, and you want to do something, and we find that a lot, and you have to have a passion for it. If you're not passionate about this, you will have a really hard time. And again, only being passionate about movies doesn't help. You have to have a sort of nice balance of being a really good artist, but also have a passion for it.
That's my last question. So thank you very much for doing this. It was really, really interesting.
Cool. No problem, Harrison. Thank you very much.